Sophie Hill. Ordinarily, most of the time, I work on issues related to Southern Africa. I, along with a collective of people in Washington, D.C., have been involved in mobilizing public protests against U.S. Corporate and government involvement and support for the apartheid regime. Sorry, I have a cold, so I'm talking a little lower than normally. As we worked on the international issue, we were always concerned that our politics would take the shape and form of using the international issue to create an opportunity for people to learn more about their local circumstance. And so we never saw the solidarity work in the international sphere as anti or divorced or separate from the local condition. And it's through our efforts working with young people in different kinds of circumstances that I want to share some of my observations to you today as a person who is an anti-imperialist, who views herself as struggling against imperialism, and a person who, one might say, works more on the macro level of problems, you know, the big systems change, who wants to talk about rearranging the whole economic social order as distinct from many people who work on structural reform, which is also a social order, as distinct from many people who work on structural reform, which is also a very important category of work. And then thirdly, there is a category of work that has to do with what one might call clinical, but it's much more social service kinds of issues. And what I find is that it's important for us as activists to really separate those out in our thinking so that we can be sure what we're doing as we're working. And it's not that those cannot be interlinked. It's simply that conceptually we have to recognize that when we're talking about sweeping economic and social kind of changes that redistribute wealth, that redistribute power and decision making, it does not necessarily deal with some of the real serious clinical problems that we have in our community that may be much more social service level work. One of the things that we've found is that for about a third of our young people, the social infrastructure of our community has broken down. It simply does not work. In our view, in my view, is symbolic of what's going to happen in this last decade of this century and even more in the 21st century. Because all of the causes of that kind of breakdown social infrastructure will continue to get worse. For example, some of the factors that cause that breakdown have to do, of course, with underemployment. It has to do with taking away economic job opportunities and infrastructure out of the community, out of the urban area. It has to do with a work organization in a society that's anti-family, that's anti the single person headed household, because the workday is very long, the transportation system takes very long, so the parent is really, through the circumstances of trying to earn an income, taken out of the context of the parenting role. So that's the kind of social infrastructure, I mean, and those are kinds of factors that, in my view, have broken that down. At the same time, we have a school system that is not only dysfunctional for many, many youth, of our youth, but it also is an enemy of our youth. It functions knowingly or unknowingly in such self-destructive ways that I thought it might be useful for me to characterize three little quick cases to just show you what happens. And these instances are young black males, because it happens to be the group that we're working with, as distinct from, I think, some very good cases could be given for what happens to black females as well, African American females. Recently, I was with a group of young men talking about violence and how violence happens in our community. And we were looking at the film section, Eyes on the Prize, which dealt with the struggle to break Jim Crow laws in the South. And they were particularly interested in the scenes where the sit-ins were taking place at the Woolworth Five and Dime counters. And after the film, we were talking about what happened, what they saw, what they thought about it. And one of the young men said to me that, you know, it's still like that for us. We still can't go in places. When we go to a mall, to go to a movie, the security guard will take our tickets, our movie ticket, if we're waiting, and tear it up and say, if you don't get out of here, I'm going to put you in jail. They said, you know, if we walk into a store, the security guards follow us around. The sales clerk follows around. There's nowhere we can go. And they began to express the same kinds of oppression and feelings of oppression that certainly we felt during the 60s, during the height of Jim Crow apartheid in the South. Except that for them, they're in a halfway house. They're finding themselves that the few social events that they may go to, they risk being killed. And so they have this no place to be somebody. Adolescence, big, young, healthy, beautiful young brothers, nowhere to be somebody, with all kinds of emotions, many of them still infantile emotions, meaning that they would like to bond, they would like to be hugged, they want somebody to praise them for what they've done, they want to be liked. But when they walk in a room, they instill fear, they instill hostility, they instill a kind of movement. And they described to me how when they're walking on the street and they said, you know, white people don't ever look at you. They get a glazed over look and they walk by you and they will even try to run into you. And then they start talking, really describing what becomes incipient violence, you know, in the sense that momentarily they lash out, and it could be a black or a white person, because at that moment the character of your disengagement from them may trigger in them a thrashing out and a response of resistance. And so oftentimes many of their crimes have to do with a resistance, an act of resistance that is defined by law as assault, among many other things. Now, that's a particular kind of case, but I think it characterized something that's happening to our young people. And one of the reasons why when you feel that sense of normlessness, when you feel that sense of not being bonded, of not being tied into anybody, then nothing matters. You can do anything. It just does not matter. But there are many other youths who are having a different kind of experience, but it also tells them that they're nothing. Recently, the elementary school system in Washington, D.C. had what is called an African History B contest. And this happens all over the city in the elementary schools, and kids study all kinds of African facts, and then they're asked these questions, and they compete, and finally someone wins. In this particular instance, two little boys won the African B contest at their school, and they went on to the national, the citywide debate. Contest, rather. Now, one of them had won first prize, and technically he was the only person who was supposed to go, but he convinced his teachers and everybody that his friends should also go, because you couldn't just lose on one and not have a chance to really try for the big time. So they both go, and his friend wins, right? But they are very happy, and they're so proud that they really went to the top. You read the newspaper article, and there are a page full of pictures. They're all African-American females. The two little boys who won, pictures were not in the paper. Now, what did that tell them? What did they learn from that? One won $300, the other one won $200. But what did that tell them? I mean, there are many lessons they could have learned. They could have learned, which this is what I understand adults told them when I tried to track down what happened. Don't worry about it. You got the money. What difference does it make? So again, reinforcing materialism as first and foremost. But on the other hand, they could have thought that they never do enough. No matter how good they are, they're never good enough. And I think that was the most profound lesson that little act taught them. And unfortunately, it's those little subtle lessons that really are making our young people feel and that they're nobody. And that no matter how much they do, it's not going to be something significant. Now, finally, I just want to characterize one third case, and we could go on and on with them, but I think I'm getting my point in it. This is a young man who is a math whiz. He can do math in his head. He doesn't have to write it on the paper, algebra and all. And he is very proud of this fact that he has this capacity, except that he is a pain to his teacher. And his teacher said in a parent conference, in which the mother invited me to come with her, because her child is constantly in trouble. He is every day. And the teacher said, well, he thinks he's so grown, he thinks he's so managed, but he's got to learn that he has to follow rules and he has to do it the way I said, and that is write it on paper. So that even when he has this wonderful talent and wonderful capability that he is developing through his own personal discipline of doing homework, it's not rewarded. If anything, he's punished for it. And so my point is that the difficulty for all three of these children is that where do they go for justice? And what are they learning about the lack of justice? And if you're constantly in an unjust situation, how do you come to value justice? Where does that come from? Now, our difficulty as a community is in living in oppressed conditions is that the social infrastructure for support, for parenting, for meeting out justice, if you will, is so distorted by institutional practices that we are not involved in, not aware of, and not at the point of the atrocities to control. That's one problem we have. Secondly, our own lives, for a goodly number of us, are so overtaken with so many complexities and various kinds of breakdowns that it's also difficult to really hang in long enough to be able to deal with this kind of individual problem that we're talking about, which is really a systemic problem for us. And then thirdly, those of us who have an analysis and who, in theory, talk about we want change and we want to do these kinds of things, we are not involved with this group of people. You know, we are not involved with this group of people. And we are not aware of the nature of their race and class and gender experiences. We're not there. And the fact that we are not there is really the substance of the critical issue that we have to deal with in this last period of this century and where we go from here. I want to close by just saying that youth need time. They just need time. They need time, they need people, they need bonding, they need a social infrastructure that tells them that they are valuable by the very fact that people are there. People are smiling, people are listening to them, people are wanting to know what they're doing, people are creating things for them to do. I mean, that's that kind of hidden curriculum. But they also need, and we also need as a people, really, we need a national liberation movement. We need a counterculture. We need what Cabral called the revolutionary culture. We need to think about what is it in terms of values, beliefs, ideals, standards of behavior. What do we want? I mean, we find ourselves, for example, giving the exact opposite image to our young people than what we think. For example, recently we have had a number of elected officials display various forms of alleged criminal behavior, and in fact, whatever found designated criminal behavior, convicted. Everything from drug use to various forms of white-collar crime. And it's clear, in my view anyway, that there is a systematic net that's thrown out to, in fact, ensnare people in their various personal contradictions that amounts to what one might call a systematic conspiracy against progressive as well as African-American officials. But the problem that I think we are not dealing with is that we are saying to youth indirectly, it's okay, because we never deal with the fact of the behavior of the person that is used by the system precisely as the drug epidemic in our community is used by the system to erode civil rights. That's a contradiction for us that we need, that we really have to come to grips with, and I'd be interested in a discussion on that later. But my point is that our youth are also getting mixed lessons, very complex and mixed lessons about what the behavior is, what's the tolerance of crime, what the tolerance of is various kinds of deviance. They get mixed lessons. They are metaphoring exactly what we're giving to them. And it seems that we've got to struggle to come up with some national approach that involves networks, that involves small groupings, but really has some values. Currently, what's emerged is what I call the anti-female model. That is the all-male classroom, because females have somehow done things to black males and really cannot be the models for them. And I think, you know, there's some real serious problems with that model. Then there's the boot camp approach. If we take these kids in and we give them this real tough and rough and authoritarian, rigid kind of experience, they'll be better. And then thirdly, there's the materialistic approach. They can come and spend time with me and see how, because I've gone to school, I now have a house, I have a car, and et cetera. And if they do this, then they can also advance up the upward mobility ladder. And all three of those models as social reform approaches in our community to deal with the problems of youth and violence and youth and drugs and youth in terms of various forms of sexual practices that may heighten their propensity to have AIDS or HIV virus are weak. We have to come up with something new. And I think that the lessons of Malcolm X, the lessons of Amilcar Cabral, the lessons of the Mozambique Liberation Movement have elements that we could learn from, but ultimately we have to shape them out of our own national contemporary experience. Thank you.